Chapter 26. Expectation. Walking across the brown-grassed village green of Emmons Field with Egwene, Elaine felt saddened by the changes. Egwene seemed stunned by them. When she first appeared in Tel Aranriod, a long braid had dangled down Egwene's back, and she was in a plain woolen dress of all things, with stout shoes peeking out beneath her skirts as she walked. Elaine supposed it was the sort of clothing she had worn when she lived in the Two Rivers. Now her dark hair hung about her shoulders, secured by a small cap of fine lace, and her garments were as fine as Elaine's, a rich blue embroidered with silver on the bodice and high neck, as well as along the hem of her skirt and her cuffs. Silver-worked velvet slippers replaced the thick leather shoes. Elaine needed to maintain her focus to keep her own green silk riding dress from altering, perhaps in embarrassing fashion, but for her friend, without any doubt, the changes were deliberate. She hoped Rand could still love Emmons Field, but it was no longer the village where he and Egwene had grown up. There were no people here in the world of dreams, yet clearly Emmons Field was a considerable town now, a prosperous town, with nearly one house in three made of well-dressed stone, some of three stories, and more roofed with tiles in every hue of the rainbow than with thatch. Some streets were paved with smooth, well-fitted stone, new and unworn as yet, and there was even a thick stone wall going up around the town, with towers and iron-plated gates that would have suited a borderland town. Outside the walls there were gristmills and sawmills, an iron foundry and large workshops for weavers of both woolens and carpets, and within were shops run by furniture makers, potters, seamstresses, cutlers, and gold and silversmiths, many as fine as could be seen in Camelin, though some of the styles seemed to be from Arad Doman or Tarabon. The air was cool but not cold, and there was not a sign of snow on the ground, at least for the moment. The sun stood straight overhead here, though Elaine hoped it was still night in the waking world. She wanted some real sleep before she had to face the morning. She was always tired the last few days. There was just so much to be done and so few hours. They had come here because it seemed unlikely any spy could find them here, but Egwene had lingered to stare at the changes in the place she was born. And Elaine had her own reasons, beyond Rand, for wanting to look over Emmons Field. The problem, one of the problems, was that 1 hour might pass in the waking world while you spent 5 or 10 in the world of dreams, but it could just as easily be the other way around. It might be morning already in Camelin. Stopping at the edge of the green, Egwene gazed back at the wide stone bridge that arched over the rapidly widening stream running from a spring that gushed out of a stone outcrop strongly enough to knock a man down. A massive marble shaft carved all over with names stood in the middle of the green, and two tall flagpoles on stone bases. "A battle monument," she murmured. "Who could imagine such a thing in Emmons Field? Though Moiraine said that once a great battle was fought on this spot, in the Trolloc Wars, when Manetheran died." "It was in the history I studied," Elaine said quietly, glancing at the bare flagpoles. Bare for the moment. She could not feel Rand here. Oh, he was still in her head as much as Birgitta, a rock-like knot of emotions and physical sensations that was even more difficult to interpret now that he was far away. Yet here in Tel Aranriod she could not know which direction he was. She missed that knowledge, small as it was. She missed him. Banners appeared atop the flagpoles, remaining just long enough to ripple once lazily. Long enough to make out on one a red eagle flying across a field of blue. Not a red eagle, the red eagle. Once, visiting this place with Nynaeve in Tel Aranriod, she had thought she glimpsed it, had decided she must be mistaken. Master Nari had begun setting her straight. She loved Rand, but if someone in the place he grew up was trying to raise Manetheran from its ancient grave, she would have to take cognizance, however much it pained him. That banner and that name still carried enough power to threaten Andor. "I heard about changes from Boda Cawthon and the other novices from home," Egwene went on, frowning at the houses around the green. "But nothing like this." Most of those houses were stone. A tiny inn still stood beside the sprawling stone foundation of some much larger building, with a huge oak growing up through the middle of it. But what looked to be an inn many times bigger was almost finished on the other side of the foundation, with a large sign reading "The Archers" already hung above the door. "I wonder whether my father is still mayor. Is my mother well, my sisters?" "I know you are moving the army tomorrow," Elaine said. "If it isn't tomorrow already. But surely you could find a few hours to visit here once you reach Tarvalen?" Traveling made such things easy. Perhaps she herself should send someone to Emmons Field, if she knew whom to trust for the mission, if she could spare anyone she did trust. Egwene shook her head. "Elaine, I've had to order women I grew up with switched because they don't believe I am the Ammerlin seat, or if they do, that they can break the rules because they knew me." Suddenly the seven-striped stole hung from her shoulders, until she noticed it with a grimace, and it vanished again. "I don't think I can face confronting Emmons Field as Ammerlin," she said sadly. "Not yet." She gave herself a shake, and her voice firmed. "The wheel turns, Elaine, and everything changes. I must get used to it. I will get used to it." She sounded a great deal like Swan Sanche, as Swan had sounded in Tarvalen before everything had changed. Stole or no stole, Egwene sounded like the Ammerlin seat. "Are you certain I can't send you some of Garth Bryn's soldiers? Enough to help secure Camelin, at least." Abruptly, they were surrounded by glistening snow, standing knee-deep in it. Snow made gleaming white mounds on the rooftops, as if from a heavy fall. This was not the first time such a thing had happened, and they simply refused to let the sudden cold touch them, rather than imagining cloaks and warmer clothes. "No one is going to move against me before spring," Elaine said. Armies did not move in winter, at least, not unless they had the benefit of traveling, like Egwene's army. Snow bogged everything down, and mud whenever the snow melted. Those borderlanders probably had begun their march south thinking winter was never coming this year. "Besides, you will need every man when you reach Tarvalen." Unsurprisingly, Egwene nodded acceptance without making the offer again. Even with this past month of hard recruiting behind her, Garth Bryn still had no more than half the soldiers he had told her would be needed to take Tarvalen. According to Egwene, he was ready to begin with what he had, but clearly it troubled her. "I have hard decisions to make, Elaine. The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, but it is still me who has to decide." Impulsively, Elaine waded through the snow and threw her arms around Egwene to hug her. At least, she started out wading. As she clasped the other woman to her, the snow vanished, leaving not so much as a damp spot on their dresses. The two of them staggered as if dancing with one another and almost fell. "I know you will make the right decision," Elaine said, laughing in spite of herself. Egwene did not join her laughter. "I hope so," she said gravely, "because whatever I decide, people are going to die for it." She patted Elaine's arm. "Well, you understand that sort of decision, don't you? We both need to be back in our beds." She hesitated before going on. "Elaine, if Rand comes to you again, you must let me know what he says, whether he gives you any clue what he means to do or where he means to go."
"I will tell you whatever I can, Egwene." Elaine felt a stab of guilt. She had told Egwene everything. Almost everything, but not that she had bonded Rand with Min and Avienda. Tower law did not prohibit what they had done. Very careful questioning of Van Deen had made that much clear. But whether it would be permitted was not clear at all. Still, as she had heard an Arafelan mercenary recruited by Brigitta say, "What was not forbidden was allowed." That sounded almost like one of Lini's old sayings, though she doubted her nurse would ever have been so permissive.
"You're troubled by him, Egwene. More than usual, I mean. I can tell. Why?"
"I have reason to be, Elaine. The eyes and ears report very troubling rumors. Only rumors, I hope. But if they aren't..." She was very much the Ammerlin seat now,
a short, slender young woman who seemed strong as steel and tall as a mountain. Determination filled her dark eyes and set her jaw. "I know you love him. I love him, too. But I am not trying to heal the White Tower just so he can chain Aes Sedai like Damani. Sleep well and have pleasant dreams, Elaine. Pleasant dreams are more valuable than people realize." And with that, she was gone, back to the waking world. For a moment, Elaine stood staring at the spot where Egwene had been. What had she been talking about? Rand would never do that. If only for love of her, he would not. She prodded that rock-hard knot in the back of her head. With him so far away, the veins of gold shone only in memory. Surely he would not. Troubled in herself, she stepped out of the dream, back to her sleeping body. She needed sleep, but no sooner was she back in her own body than sunlight fell on her eyelids. What hour was it? She had appointments to keep, duties to carry out. She wanted to sleep for months. She wrestled with duty, but duty won. She had a busy day ahead. Every day was a busy day. Her eyes popped open, feeling grainy as if she had not slept at all. By the slant of light through the windows, it was well beyond sunrise. She could simply lie there. Duty. Avienda shifted in her sleep, and Elaine poked her sharply in the ribs. If she had to be awake, then Avienda was not going to loll about. Avienda woke with a start, stretching for her knife lying atop the small table on her side of the bed. Before her hand touched the dark horn hilt, she let it fall. "Something woke me," she muttered. "I thought a Shido was... Look at the sun! Why did you let me sleep so late?" she demanded, scrambling from the bed. "Just because I'm allowed to stay with you." The words were muffled for an instant as she jerked her sleep-wrinkled shift off over her head. "Does not mean Monaella won't switch me if she thinks I'm being lazy. Do you mean to lie there all day?" With a groan, Elaine climbed out of the bed. Asanda was already waiting at the door to the dressing room. She never waked Elaine unless Elaine remembered to order it. Elaine surrendered herself to the white-haired woman's almost silent ministrations while Avienda dressed herself. But her sister made up for Asanda's quiet with a laughing string of comments along the line of how having someone else put your clothes on you must feel like being a baby again, and how Elaine might forget how to put on her own clothes and need somebody to dress her. She had done very much the same every morning since they had begun to share the same bed. Avienda found it very funny. Elaine did not say a word, except to answer her tirewoman's suggestions on what she should wear, until the last mother-of-pearl button was done up and she stood examining herself in the stand mirror. "Asanda," she said then, casually, "are Avienda's clothes ready?" The fine blue wool with the little silver embroidery would do well enough for what she faced today. Asanda brightened. "All Lady Avienda's pretty silks and laces, my lady? Oh, yes, all brushed and cleaned and ironed and put away." She gestured to the wardrobes lining one wall. Elaine smiled over her shoulder at her sister. Avienda stared at the wardrobes as though they contained vipers, then gulped and hastily finished winding the dark folded kerchief around her head. When Elaine had dismissed Asanda, she said, "Just in case you need them." "Very well," Avienda muttered, putting on her silver necklace. "No more jokes about the woman dressing you." "Good. Or I'll tell her to start dressing you. Now that would be amusing." Grumbling under her breath about people who could not take a joke, Avienda plainly did not agree. Elaine half expected her to demand that all the clothes she had acquired be discarded. She was a little surprised Avienda had not seen to it already. For Avienda, the breakfast laid out in the sitting room consisted of cured ham with raisins, eggs cooked with dried plums, dried fish prepared with pine nuts, fresh bread slathered with butter, and tea made syrupy with honey. Well, not actually syrupy, but it seemed so. Elaine got no butter on her bread, very little honey in her tea, and instead of the rest, a hot porridge of grains and herbs that was supposed to be especially healthy. She did not feel with child, no matter what Min had told Avienda, but Min had told Brigitte, too, once the three of them began getting drunk. Between her warder, Dailin, and Rena Harfour, she now found herself limited to a diet suitable for a woman in her condition. If she sent to the kitchens for a treat, somehow it never arrived, and if she slipped down there herself,
The cooks gave her such glum, disapproving stares that she slipped back out again with nothing. She did not really mourn the spiced wine and sweets and the other things she was no longer allowed. Not that much, anyway, except when Avienda was gobbling tarts or puddings. But everyone in the palace knew she was pregnant. And, of course, that meant they knew how she had gotten that way, if not with whom. The men were not too bad, beyond the fact that they knew, and she knew they knew, but the women did not bother to hide knowing. Whether they accepted or deprecated the situation, half looked at her as though she were a hoyden, and the other half with speculation. Forcing herself to swallow the porridge, it was not that bad, really, but she dearly would have loved some of the ham Avienda was slicing, or a little of the egg with plums. Spooning lumpy porridge into her mouth, she almost looked forward to the start of birthing sickness so she could share the queasy belly with Brigitta. The first visitor to enter her apartments that morning beside Asanda was the leading candidate among the palace women for the father of her barely quickened child. "My queen," Captain Mellar said, sweeping off his plumed hat in a flourishing bow. "The chief clerk awaits your majesty's pleasure." The captain's dark, unblinking eyes said he would never have dreams of the men he killed, and the lace-edged sash across his chest and the lace at his neck and wrists only made him look harder. Wiping grease from her chin with a linen napkin, Avienda watched him with no expression on her face. The two guardswomen, standing one on either side of the doors, grimaced faintly. Mellar already had a reputation for pinching guardswomen's bottoms, the prettier ones at least, not to mention disparaging their abilities in the city's taverns. The second was far worse, in the guardswomen's eyes. "I am not a queen yet, Captain," Elaine said briskly. She always tried to keep as much to the point as possible with the man. "How is recruiting for my bodyguard coming along?"
"Only 32 so far, my lady."
Still holding his hat, the hatchet-faced man rested both hands on his sword hilt, his lounging posture hardly suitable for the presence of one he had called his queen. Nor was his grin.
"Lady Brigitta has exacting standards. Not many women can match them. Give me 10 days and I can find 100 men who'll better them and hold you as dear in their hearts as I do."
"I think not, Captain Mellar." It was an effort to keep a chill out of her voice. He had to have heard the rumors concerning himself and her. Could he think that just because she had not denied them, she might actually find him attractive? Pushing away the half-empty porridge bowl, she suppressed a shudder. 32 so far? The numbers were growing quickly. Some of the hunters for the horn who had been demanding rank had decided that serving in Elaine's bodyguard carried a certain flair. She conceded that the women could not all be on duty day and night, but no matter what Brigitta said, the goal of 100 seemed excessive. The woman dug in her heels now at any suggestion of fewer, though. "Please tell the chief clerk he can come in," she told him. He swept her another elaborate bow. She rose to follow him, and as he pulled one of the lion-carved doors open, she laid a hand on his arm and smiled. "Thank you again for saving my life, Captain," she said, this time warm enough for a caress. The fellow smirked at her. The guardswomen stared straight ahead, frozen, those she could see out in the hall before the doors closed behind him, as well as those inside. And when Elaine turned around, Avienda was staring at her with little more expression than she had shown Mellar. That little was pure amazement, though, Elaine sighed. Crossing the carpets, she bent to put an arm around her sister and spoke softly, for her ear alone. She trusted the women of her bodyguard with things she told very few others, but there were some matters she dared not trust to them.
"I saw a maid passing, Avienda. Maids gossip worse than men. The more who think this child is Doylan Mellar's, the safer it will be. If necessary, I'll let the man pinch my bottom."
"I see," Avienda said slowly, and frowned into her plate, as though seeing something other than the eggs and plums she began pushing around with her spoon.
Master Nori presented his usual blend of mundane maintenance of the palace and the city, tidbits from his correspondence in foreign capitals, and information gleaned from merchants and bankers and others who had dealings beyond the borders. But his first piece of news was by far the most important to her, if not the most interesting.
The two most prominent bankers in the city are amenable, my lady, he said in that dry-as-dust voice of his. Clutching his leather folder to his narrow chest, he eyed Avienda sideways. He was still not accustomed to her presence while he made his reports. Or the guardswomen. Avienda bared her teeth at him, and he blinked, then coughed into a bony hand. Master Hoffley and Mistress Andscale were somewhat hesitant at first, but they know the market for alum as well as I. It would not be safe to say that their coffers are now yours, but I have arranged for 20,000 gold crowns to be moved to the palace strongroom, and more will come as needed.
Inform the Lady Brigitta, Elaine told him, hiding her relief.
Brigitta had not yet signed enough new guards to hold a city as large as Camelin, much less do anything else, but Elaine could not expect to see revenue from her estates before spring, and the mercenaries were expensive. Now she would not lose them for lack of gold before Brigitta recruited men to replace them.
Next, Master Nori?
I fear the sewers must be given a high priority, my lady. The rats are breeding in them as if it were spring, and...
He mingled it all together, according to what he felt was most pressing. Nori seemed to take it as a personal failure that he had not yet learned who had freed Elenia and Neyan, though less than a week had passed since their rescue. The price of grain was climbing exorbitantly, along with that of every other sort of foodstuff, and it was already apparent that repairs to the palace roof would take longer and cost more than the masons had first estimated, but food always grew more expensive as winter went on, and masons always cost more than they first had said they would. Nori admitted that his last correspondence from New Brame was several days old, but the Borderlanders appeared content to remain where they were, which he could not understand. Any army, much less one as large as this was said to be, ought to be stripping the countryside around it bare by now. Elaine did not understand why either, but she was content that it was so, for the time being. Rumors in Cairhien of Aes Sedai swearing fealty to Rand at least gave a reason for Egwene's concern, though it hardly seemed likely any sister would actually do such a thing. That was the least important news in Nori's estimation, but not in hers. Rand could not afford to alienate the sisters with Egwene. He could not afford to alienate any Aes Sedai. But he did seem to find ways to do so. Rena Harfor soon replaced Halwyn Nori, nodding to the bodyguards at the door in passing and giving Avienda an open smile. If the plump, graying woman had ever been uncertain about Elaine calling Avienda sister, she had never shown it, and now she genuinely appeared to approve. Smiles or no smiles, though, her report was much more grim than anything in the chief clerk's.
"John Skellet is in the pay of House Arawn, my lady," Rena said, her round face stern enough to fit a hangman. "Twice now he has been seen accepting a purse from men known to favor Arawn. And there is no doubt that Esther Norham is in someone's pay. She isn't stealing, but she has over 50 crowns of gold hidden under a loose floorboard, and she added 10 crowns last night."
"Do as with the others," Elaine said sadly. The first maid had uncovered 9 spies she was certain of so far, 4 of them employed by people Rena had not yet been able to uncover. That Rena had found any at all were enough to anger Elaine, but the barber and the hairdresser were something more. Both had been in her mother's service. A pity they had not seen fit to transfer their loyalty to Morgaze's daughter. Avienda grimaced as Mistress Harfor murmured that she would, but there was no point in discharging the spies or killing them as Avienda had suggested. They would just be replaced by spies she did not know. "A spy is your enemy's tool until you know her," her mother had said, "but then she is your tool." "When you find a spy," Tom had told her, "wrap him in swaddling and feed him with a spoon." The men and women who had betrayed their service would be allowed to discover what Elaine wanted them to know, not all true, such as the numbers Brigitta had recruited.
"And the other matter, Mistress Harfor?"
"Nothing yet, my lady, but I have hopes," Rena said, even more grimly than before. "I have hopes."
Following the first maid's departure came 2 delegations of merchants.
First a large group of Kandori with gem-studded earrings and silver guild chains draped across their chests, and then, right behind them, half a dozen Ilianers with only a touch of embroidery on otherwise somber coats and dresses. She used one of the smaller reception rooms. The tapestries flanking the marble fireplace were of hunting scenes, not the white lion, and the polished wooden wall panels were uncarved. They were merchants, not diplomats, though some seemed to feel slighted that she offered only wine and did not drink with them. Kandori or Ilianers, they also looked askance at the two guardswomen who followed her into the room and posted themselves beside the door, though if by this time they had not heard the tales of an attempt to kill her, they must be deaf. Six more of her bodyguard waited outside the door. The Kandori studied Avienda surreptitiously when not listening attentively to Elaine, and the Ilianers avoided looking at her at all after the first widening of eyes in surprise. Doubtless they read significance into the presence of an Aiel, even if she only sat on the floor in a corner and said nothing. But whether Kandori or Ilianers, the merchants wanted the same thing. Reassurance that Elaine would not so anger the Dragon Reborn that he would interfere with trade by sending his armies and his Aiel to ravage Andor, though they did not come out and say so. Nor did they mention that Aiel and the Legion of the Dragon both had large encampments not many miles from Camelin. Their polite questions about her plans, now that she had removed the dragon banners and the banners of light from Camelin, were sufficient. She told them what she told everyone, that Andor would ally itself to the Dragon Reborn, but was not his conquest. In return, they offered vague wishes for her well-being, suggesting that they supported her claim to the Lion Throne wholeheartedly without actually saying any such thing. After all, if she failed, they would want to be welcome in Andor under whoever did gain the crown. When the Ilianers had made their bows and curtsies and departed, she closed her eyes for a moment and rubbed her temples. She still had a meeting with a delegation of glassmakers before the midday meal, and five more with merchants or craftsfolk later. A very busy day, full of mealy-mouthed platitudes and ambiguity. And with Nynaeve and Marilla gone, it was her turn to teach the Windfinders again tonight, at best a less pleasant experience than the worst meeting with merchants, which might leave her a little time to study the Turangreal they had brought out of Ebu Dar before she was so weary that she could no longer keep her eyes open. It was embarrassing when Avienda had to half-carry her to bed, but she could not stop. There was too much to be done and not enough time in a day. There was almost an hour before the glassmakers, but Avienda ruthlessly rode over her suggestion that she might take a peek at the things from Ebu Dar. "Has Birgitta been talking to you?" Elaine demanded as her sister all but dragged her up a narrow flight of stone stairs. Four guardswomen went ahead, and the others trailed behind, studiously ignoring what passed between her and Avienda. Though she thought that Rasoria Domanchi, a stocky hunter for the horn with the blue eyes and yellow hair occasionally found among Tyrans, wore a tiny smile. "Do I need her to tell me you spend too many hours inside and sleep too little?" Avienda replied contemptuously. "You need fresh air." The air in the high colonnade was certainly fresh and crisp, though the sun stood high in a gray sky. A cold breeze blew around the smooth columns, so the guardswomen standing ready to protect her from pigeons had to hang on to their plumed hats. Perversely, Elaine refused to ignore the chill. "Dialin talked to you," she grumbled, shivering. Dialin claimed a woman with child needed long walks every day. She had been quick to remind Elaine that, daughter heir or not, she was really only the high seat of House Trakand for the moment, and if the high seat of Trakand wanted to talk with the high seat of Taravin, she could do it tramping up and down the palace corridors or not at all. "Monaela has borne 7 children," Avienda replied. "She says I must see you get fresh air." Despite no more than her shawl pulled over her shoulders, she gave no sign of feeling the wind. But then Aiel were as good as the sisters at ignoring the elements. Wrapping her arms around herself, Elaine scowled. "Stop sulking, sister," Avienda said. She pointed down to one of the stable yards just visible over the white-tiled roofs. "Look, Rhianna Corley is already checking to see if Marilla Siandevin is returning." The familiar vertical slash of light appeared in the stable yard and rotated into a hole in the air 10 feet tall and as wide. Elaine scowled down at Rihanna's head. She was not sulking. Perhaps she should not have taught Rihanna to travel, since the kinswoman was not yet Aes Sedai, but none of the other sisters were strong enough to make the weave work, and if the Windfinders were allowed to learn, then the few kinswomen who could should be allowed too in her book. Besides, she could not do everything herself. Light, had winter been this icy before she learned to stop heat and cold from touching her? To her surprise, Marilla rode through the gateway, shaking snow from her dark fur-lined cloak, followed by the helmeted guardsman who had been sent off with her 7 days earlier. Zaida and the Windfinders had been most unpleasant over her disappearance, to put it mildly, but the Grey had leaped at a chance to escape them for however long. It had been necessary to check for her every day, opening a gateway to the same spot, yet Elaine had not expected her for a week yet at the very best. As the last of the 10 red-cloaked guards entered the stable-yard, the slim little Grey sister climbed down from her saddle, handed her reins to a groom, and hurried into the palace before the woman from the stables could more than get out of her way. "I am enjoying the fresh air," Elaine said, just keeping her teeth from chattering. "But if Marilla is back, I must go down." Avienda quirked an eyebrow as if she suspected the evasion, but she was the first to start for the stairs. Marilla's return was important, and by her haste she brought either very good news or very bad. By the time Elaine and her sister walked into her sitting room, followed by two of the guardswomen, of course, who planted themselves beside the doors, Marilla was already there. Her damp spotted cloak lay over the back of a chair, her pale gray riding gloves were tucked behind her belt, and her black hair could have used a brush. With purple crescents under her dark eyes, Marilla's pale face looked as weary as Elaine felt. As quickly as she had come up from the stable yard, she was not alone. Birgitta, frowning pensively, stood with one hand on the carved mantle over the fireplace. The other gripped her long golden braid, almost like Nynaeve. Today she wore voluminous dark green trousers with her short red coat, a combination to make the eye flinch. And Captain Mellar made Elaine an elaborate bow, waving his white-plumed hat about. He had no place here, but she let him stay, and even gave him a very warm smile. Very warm. The plump young maid who had just placed a large silver tray on one of the sideboards blinked and looked wide-eyed at Mellar before remembering to make her curtsy on going. Elaine held her smile until the door closed. Whatever protected her baby, she was willing to do. There was hot spiced wine on the rope work tray for everyone else, and weak tea for her. Well, at least it was hot. "I was quite lucky," Marilla sighed once she was seated, giving Mellar an uncertain glance over her wine cup. She knew the tale of him saving Elaine's life, but she had left before the rumors began. It turned out that Rihanna had opened her gateway not 5 miles from the Borderlanders. They have not moved since arriving." Her nose wrinkled. "If not for the weather, the stench of latrines and horse dung would be overpowering. You were right, Elaine. All 4 rulers are there, in 4 camps a few miles apart. Each holds an army. I found the Shinarans the first day, and most of my time since has been spent talking with Isar of Shinar and the other 3. We met in a different camp each day." "You spent a little time looking, too, I hope?" Birgitta said respectfully from in front of the fireplace. She was respectful with every Aes Sedai except the one she was bonded to. "How many are they?"
"I don't suppose you got an accurate count," Mellar put in, sounding as though he expected anything but. For once his narrow face was unsmiling. Peering into his wine, he shrugged. "Whatever you saw might have some value, though. If there are enough of them, they may starve themselves before they can threaten Camelin. The largest army in the world is just so many walking corpses without food and fodder."
He laughed. Birgitta stared at his back darkly, but Elaine lifted a hand slightly at her side, motioning the other woman to keep silent. "They are not in a good way for food, Captain," Marilla said coolly, sitting up straighter in spite of her obvious fatigue. "But neither are they starving quite yet. I should not count on starvation to defeat them if it comes to that." After a little time away from the sea folk, her big eyes were no longer perpetually startled, and despite her smooth Aes Sedai composure, it was plain she had decided to dislike Doylan Mellar no matter whose life he had saved.
As for numbers, something over 200,000, I should say, and I very much doubt anyone but their own officers could be more accurate than that. Even hungry, that is a great many swords. Melar shrugged again, undisturbed by Aes Sedai's stares. The slim gray sister neither looked at him again nor ignored him in any obvious way. He just seemed to become a piece of the furniture for her as she went on. There are at least 10 sisters with them, Elaine, though they made a great effort to hide the fact. Not adherents to Egwene, I should think, though they need not be Elida's either. A good many sisters appear to be sitting to one side until the tower's troubles are over, I fear. She sighed again, perhaps not from tiredness this time. With a grimace, Elaine set her teacup aside. The kitchens had not sent up any honey, and she really did not like it bitter. What do they want, Marilla? The rulers, not the sisters. 10 sisters made that army 10 times as dangerous, especially to Rand. No, to anyone. They haven't been sitting there in the snow all this time for the joy of it. The gray spread her slim hands slightly. Over the long run, I can only make suppositions. Over the short, they want to meet you, and as soon as possible. They sent riders toward Camelin when they arrived at New Braem, but this time of year it might take another week or more before they arrive here. Tenobia of Saldea let slip, or pretended to let slip, that they know you have some connection to, or at least a close acquaintance with, a certain person in whom they also apparently have an interest. Somehow they know of your presence in Falma when certain events took place. Melar frowned in confusion, but no one enlightened him. I did not disclose traveling because of those sisters, but I did say I could return with a reply very soon. Elaine exchanged a look with Brigitte, who also shrugged, though in her case neither from detachment nor from disdain. The largest hole in Elaine's hopes to use the Borderlanders to influence her opponents for the throne had been how to approach sitting rulers while she was merely the high seat of Trakand and daughter-heir of a deceased queen. Brigitte's shrug said be thankful for the hole closing, but Elaine wondered how these people from the Borderlands had learned what very few others knew. And if they knew, how many more did, too? She would protect her unborn child. "Would you be willing to go back right away, Marilla?" she asked. The other sister accepted with alacrity, and with a slight widening of her eyes that suggested she would put up with any amount of stench to avoid returning to the Windfinders a little longer. "Then we will go together. If they want to meet me soon, nothing can be sooner than today." They knew too much for delay. Nothing could be allowed to threaten her child. Nothing.